Welcome to the Evanston Public Library. This is one of our many wonderful collaborations with Evanston Neighbors for Peace. My name is Leslie Williams, and I'm head of adult services for the Evanston Public Library. And we really feel that programs like this are an essential part of our mission to engage and inform the Evanston community about current contemporary issues that are of importance to all of us. We do collaborations like this with other neighborhood groups as well. So if you know of another organization that would like to collaborate with the library on a program, that would be wonderful. And you can just tell them to contact me here at the Evanston Public Library. All of our programs are listed on our website, which is epl.org. I would like to introduce now a representative from Neighbors for Peace who will tell you a little bit more about the movie that we're going to show and about our speakers. So I'd like to welcome Dale Lehman from Neighbors for Peace.
Thank you, Leslie. And thank you to the people of Evanston who helped fund this terrific facility that makes these kind of programs possible as part of its open-minded approach to good citizenship and citizen-led government. I'm actually just going to briefly say that Neighbors for Peace is predominantly located in Evanston. We operate out of St. Nick's, and you can find us on the website, neighborsforpeace.org, or you can sign up at our at the table in the back where we have a little collection box for donations. To be contacted, and we can tell you about the kind of activities we do. Mostly, we're doing educational forums like this, getting the word out, getting people to feel that they have a right to have their voice heard, and that their voice is meaningful and important, and that they actually have some power in the society, even though we're told we should pay deference to people with money, and that we should let our betters in Washington tell us what's in our own interest. Obviously, you can see that we've been led down a path so that it's pretty blatant that our interests are not being protected or looked after by the current leadership in Washington or the people who they answer to on Wall Street. So with that, I will invite you to participate with Neighbors for Peace, and if not directly, in future programs. And I'll bring up Joe Scarry, who's going to tell you a little bit about this film. Welcome, Joe.
So thank you to Neighbors for Peace for having this event today, to the Evanston Public Library. And most of all, thank you to you for being here and for all of your activism. And I want to take a minute to echo what Dale just said. It's so important that everybody look at these kinds of things that we're doing, like this event today. I was just at a teach-in that's going on all day downtown. There's a big rally on Wednesday about Guantanamo. There'll be another screening next Saturday of Andy Worthington's film. It's so important that you look at these and ask yourselves the questions, what can I do? And I know many of you already do that, because in fact, we are the people who can make a difference. I became involved with this film after seeing it in a setting very much like the one we're in today. I went down to the Siskel Center about 2.5 years ago to a screening that was being done principally for attorneys who were in town for an ABA event. And I knew very little about Guantanamo except that, you know, it was one of those bad things that was going on right now, and probably some torture going on there and whatnot, but I didn't really have my mind around what it was all about. And the film was introduced that day by the producer, Sig Leibowitz, who you'll see in the film, and he explained the inception of the film. He had been in the middle of a career in Hollywood, participating in productions of TV shows like The Sopranos and Law and Order, and producing films like In the Bedroom, and everything was going along swimmingly. And then there were some family issues, and he had to go back to living in Baltimore, where his family was from. And in the course of that, he had the opportunity to go to law school. So as he was sorting out some things that he needed to do for his family, he was also becoming a lawyer. And as he sat one day in the course on international law, in which there really was no textbook because the law was changing so fast. This was probably 2004 or so. He was given a handout of the kind that they were given every day, but this was a handout that was just 5 pages of transcript that a very brave judge had released of a hearing relating to Guantanamo. And at that time, there was very little information available. And as he looked at these 5 pages, much of which was very heavily redacted, so as he's looking at what's written and he's looking at what's blacked out, he thought to himself, my God, if this is what they'll let us see, what is the part that they're hiding from us? And he realized in that moment that he really needed to get this story out to the public. So from that point started the process of trying to make a film. And there was research which eventually uncovered thousands of pages of documents from which he was able to create the film you're about to see. And I want to emphasize, the film is based on actual transcripts. So the first 20 minutes or so that's taking place in a courtroom are words which are familiar to many attorneys in this field who have dealt with some of the appeals of these detainees. And he was also able to get the support to make this film. And it's particularly inspiring to me that somebody who didn't have the resources, he didn't have the money, and certainly it's not bankable, was able to find a little bit of money here, a little bit of money there, including from the university. And he was able to call upon some people that he knew from Hollywood, and we'll talk about that a little bit after the film, to contribute their efforts to make the film. So what you're seeing here is a group effort which eventually was shortlisted for an Academy Award about a very specific part of what the country is doing today in Guantanamo, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. So let's look at the response.
This hearing shall come to order. For the record, the 3 tribunal panel members have been previously sworn, as have the tribunal court recorder, the translator, and the detainee's personal representative. Sir, you may be present at all open, non-classified sessions of your tribunal hearing. That is why you are here today. A reminder that if you become disorderly, you will be removed from the hearing, and the tribunal will continue to hear evidence in your absence. You are also reminded that you do not have to testify, but you may if you wish. Prior to today's hearing, you provided a Muslim oath, and I remind you that any testimony you give today will be considered to be under oath to tell the truth. Please translate all that to the witness and ask him if he understands.
No, I do not require translator. I understand. I can speak for myself, and I wish to do so. I know that I am under oath both to you and to Allah.
Very well then. Mr. Al-Agar, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I have one question, concern, if I may ask.
Yes, of course.
For more than 4 years now, I have been a guest of your country here in Cuba. But I am not a guest, and this is not your country. I only ask this tribunal that you please make a decision. Make a decision and let me go home. This is why I have come here today.
Very well. You may begin.
The allegations forming the basis of the defendant's detention. Mr. Hassan Ali Al-Akar, while living in Pakistan and Afghanistan, associated with a known Al-Qaeda cell and gave material support to an Al-Qaeda operative.
What have you to say to this allegation, Mr. Alagar?
I cannot answer this allegation. You see, for 4 years I cannot answer this allegation. Because if you tell me the name of this person who is saying that I have helped Al-Qaeda, who is this person? How can I answer this charge?
Did you or did you not know anyone who was a member of Al-Qaeda?
No. No, I knew no one.
You lived in Pakistan for 3 years, correct?
Yes, 3 years and 2 months.
And during that time you traveled repeatedly into Afghanistan?
Yes, yes, of course. Well, this is where the work I was overseeing was to be done.
Your work involved overseeing the construction of a mosque and an Islamic social hall, correct?
Yes.
And in that time, those 3 years and 2 months, many of your associates were involved with money laundering and the purchase of guns and weapons for Al-Qaeda. Is that correct?
For 4 years, I've told the interrogators I don't have any knowledge of this. Who is this person who is saying that I am involved in this? Tell me his name, and then maybe I can tell you if I know him. But I don't know if he's a terrorist. Maybe I know him as a friend. Maybe I know him as a member of my team, or he's somebody who worked for me. But I don't even know if this person is a Bosnian or a Jordanian, Saudi, or even one of your American Indians.
Noting the dearth of American Indians working on the construction of mosques in the Middle East, sir, would you please answer my question?
If you tell me his name, this person, then I can answer and defend myself against this accusation.
Sir, we are asking the questions, and we need you to respond to what we ask and only what we ask. Let's move on.
Before we proceed, if I may, mm-hmm. I'm curious. I'd like to know from the detainee where he learned to speak English so well.
As I'm sure my file indicates, I learned to speak English both in my country and then during my PhD training in England.
You studied and worked in London during the 1990s, correct?
Yes.
This was a period of radical Islamic outreach into the mosques of London.
I was not involved in any of that.
But you knew what was going on all around you. Mr. Alkar, while in London, you worked for a Saudi engineering firm, correct?
Yes, I was the project manager.
And during those years, you attended two mosques of the Wahhabi sect?
I did, but that is not a crime in your country that claims to defend religious freedoms.
No, in our country, it's not a crime. But you weren't studying at radical mosques in our country, were you?
Sir, I studied at no radical mosques anywhere. When I pray to rise closer to God. That, I find, is best done when I do not listen to the babble of men around me.
Court recorder, please read into the record the next allegation.
The detainee was arrested as he was attempting to plant and detonate a bomb at the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad.
That statement is untrue. I did not plan or do or even think any such thing.
You are trained in explosives, correct?
Yes, I am an engineer. I have studied demolition techniques. I have nothing to hide. Often it is the case that before we build a new building, we have to tear down the old one first. Part of my job is to know how to do that. But, learned judges, when I was arrested, did you find any explosives upon me? Did you find any weapons? Did you even find me standing there in front of your embassy?
Mr. Alakar, your arrest took place before the bomb went off. One doesn't have to be storing explosives on his person or in his home to be a terrorist threat.
I am prepared now to make you an offer. If you have any evidence, any proof, even very little proof, that I was standing in front of your embassy and I was going like that, then I am prepared to be punished. Punish me. But I can only say that I did not do any of these things, and I am tired of repeating myself.
Sir, I sympathize with your frustration, but I must ask you again to simply answer our questions and we can try to make this process as brief as possible.
Brief, I have been here for more than 4 years with no attorney, only this man that you have given me, who is not a lawyer and who I cannot speak to confidentially because he must tell you everything I say. So what do I even have? I have these accusations. You tell me that I am Al-Qaeda, but I am not Al-Qaeda. But I have no way to prove this to you. Except go and ask Bin Laden, catch him in his cave, ask him if I'm Al-Qaeda. What should happen is that you should provide me with evidence. prove these accusations, because I cannot provide you with evidence of things I did not do. I can only say, no, I did not do that, and that's it.
Mr. Aligarh, while I...
It is not fair that I have lost more than 4 years of my life with my family. My girls were 3 and 1 year old when I came here. How will they know me now? How will I even be their father? How long do I have to sit here and suffer because somebody said that I am this thing, or somebody said that I have some information? If you have any evidence to show me today, then please prove it and kill me, and I don't mind.
We appreciate your decision to participate.
I want to participate. I have been completely honest. I want to make another statement. I was contacted by an attorney in the United States. She wrote me a letter and urged me not to participate in this hearing. But I said no. I said I want to participate because I want to show you my side, to show you that I'm really innocent. Because the innocent, no matter how you try to cover up their innocence will show through.
Here's the part that puzzles me. We hear you, sir, claiming your innocence. But in all your protests, why is it you never answer our questions? You are a highly trained engineer with an impressive education, as well as experience and technical know-how regarding explosives and structural design. You managed a work site employing a number of now-known terrorists.
Not to my knowledge.
Or so you claim, but they worked for you nonetheless.
Do you know how many men we have working for us? I do not hire them. I'm not the foreman. I am an engineer. I design. I follow orders. These men are hired by others.
So say you.
You can contact my supervisors in Islamabad, and they will attest to the fact that I do not hire these men.
On two occasions, we put through your request to your supervisors to report to us by this tribunal date. Both requests emphasized this date, but we received no answer.
Why? Why would they not report?
We want to know the same thing. And I also want to know this. You have a PhD from a prestigious university. You can work in nicer places, near your family, and make a considerable salary. But you chose, not someone else, but you yourself, you chose to work on a project far away from your family, who you now profess to care so much about.
It was a religious calling.
What does that mean?
It means what it means.
That's it. You have nothing more to say.
What more would I say? I went there to help people. Just like in the West, you have missionaries that go out into the world to help people. We have the same thing. This organization, we went to pull people towards God, to help people. I mean, look, I went to a poor country to build a mosque. If there were workers there who are Al-Qaeda, then please go after them. I am an engineer.
That's exactly our question, sir. These men who worked for you, they were uneducated day laborers, correct?
Yes, yes.
How did these men, who lacked the training or the necessary engineering background, construct the sophisticated weapons that were found? Where, Mr. Aligarh, did these men get the technical...
Am I the only engineer in the entire country? Listen, when I was arrested along with the others, we were bound, treated the worst treatment. 36 hours, sir, without food or water. I was shackled and beaten and brought all the way here to Cuba. And I told you at that time, I know nothing. And I'm telling you now, I know nothing. I cannot explain to you these
that
things.
That still doesn't answer
Excuse
the question.
Me, Colonel. Who beat you? Did you say you were beaten?
They broke the fingers in my hand. I cannot close my hand.
Are you saying a soldier here at Guantanamo broke your fingers?
Sir, the soldiers, they put me on the ground. They tied my hands and feet. They pushed my face into the rocks. Another soldier came and he put his knee in my face and he beat me. And then the rocks, they flew into my eyes. If my head had been turned just a little bit more, I would have lost an eye. There are many, many things about the soldiers that I don't like to talk about.
Did you report this?
Hold on. Where is your proof of this allegation?
Where is the proof? Where is your proof of these accusations?
There are classified reports which place you at the center of a bombing conspiracy.
Where? Where is this classified documents? Why can I not see them? If there are documents that I cannot see, I do not want them to be used in this tribunal record against me.
Unfortunately, sir, as you have been informed, under the rules of these tribunals, we're not allowed to show you the classified material against you.
I don't want any documents that I cannot see to say if it is true or not to be used against me.
I understand, but the classified documents have been classified by another government agency. They have determined that releasing them to you may cause our country possible damage.
There are national security precautions which prevent us from releasing our sources or providing any classified material that could assist a terrorist group in their attacks against us.
Let me ask one question, please. Have you found anyone to be innocent? If not, then there is no need to continue, because this is a joke.
Mr. Alucard, these tribunals don't sentence people to guilt or innocence.
This isn't a judicial proceeding, per se, but an administrative hearing to determine if you have been properly classified as an enemy combatant.
So I must wait for another trial where nobody can tell me anything.
I don't know when such a trial would take place, nor at that time what evidence would be shown to you.
My future has been destroyed, and this is all you can offer me.
Mr. Alucard, I have a question. When the Pakistani police searched your house, they reported finding an AK-47 Kalashnikov in your residence.
Yes. Yes, they did. What? I'm going to make war on the United States with one lousy AK-47? Everybody in Pakistan has a Kalashnikov. And Afghanistan too. Sadly, that is the reality of life in that part of the world. If a terrorist walks into a convenience store and buys a pack of cigarettes, then when he leaves, the convenience store owner is also a terrorist?
Sir, we're not talking about a grocery store. This organization you were working for, the Al-Najid Islamic Organization,
yes,
is a suspected terrorist front.
What? This is not true. This is not true. This is the first time hearing of this. Why is this the first time I'm hearing of this? If this is true, then you should go after Saudi Arabia. Because Saudi Arabia is the country that established Al-Najid. Their president is a Saudi royal prince.
While employed for Al-Najid, you worked with one Ali Al-Memza.
Yes. Yes, I did. Indirectly. It was a humanitarian effort. We were to build a mosque and then a hospital in the north of the country, but we never finished the work before I was taken. Why? What does Ali Al-Memza have to do with this? What?
This humanitarian organization of yours is merely a cover to mask travel and activities of terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
This is not true. This is not the work I saw. This is a humanitarian organization. It is helping the Muslims, the Ulama. It is a missionary organization.
A missionary organization?
Yes. Look, if there are people who are using this organization for terrorist activities, then you go after them and you kill them. But I have been here for 4 years, and nobody, no interrogator, no one has ever mentioned any of this to me. So why am I hearing this now? Why is it just coming out now?
Sir, you were the second highest ranking official in the organization's Afghan division at that time.
Look, if America is determining that this organization was a front for Al-Qaeda, then fine. Prove that there were terrorists there, go after them, kill them. I don't care. I have nothing to do with this.
Do you believe in jihad?
I believe in Islam. Do not dissect Islam.
I'm not. I want to state for the record that I am trying to be respectful. All I'm asking is, do you believe in jihad?
I cannot answer this question. This is a mysterious question to me. I cannot answer it.
What is the meaning of jihad to you?
To me, the meaning of jihad is many things. It could mean helping someone like the Prophet. Or it could mean fighting injustice, like when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and the people in that country rose up to defend their country. Don't think that when you're talking about jihad, you're always talking about somebody killing somebody.
Then what does it mean?
It could mean somebody helping somebody. Building roads, schools, hospitals, all of these are part of the jihad. So when I went to Afghanistan and Pakistan, I went there just to do the humanitarian part of the jihad.
Jihad does also include killing people, correct?
Yes, it does. But not for me.
We understand that this is a difficult process, and we appreciate your cooperation. Do you have anything further to add?
No.
We will adjourn this open session with the comment that I would like to make to the detainee, that we will consider these matters carefully and make our determination accordingly.
Yes, sir.
And then thanks for your loyal service. They reward you with Gitmo.
How fresh is that coffee?
Just arrived.
Thank God. I'm dying for some since the hearing started.
Imagine how the detainee felt.
I would have shared.
Okay, let's proceed. The question before us is whether the detainee has been properly classified as an unlawful enemy combatant. The government's declaration contains classified evidence against the detainee, linking him to a number of terrorist acts.
Bomb making, explosives trading, leading to the deaths of over 40 U.S. soldiers, plus two attempted bombings of U.S. embassies. This is a hell of a report.
Question. The tribunal rules allow us to consider hearsay and even confessions given under torture, correct?
That's correct, if you find that it's reliable.
Well, that's my question. Seeing as this is my first tribunal, how exactly do we determine the reliability of the evidence? On what basis?
This is my third tribunal, Captain. When I figure that out, you'll be the first to know.
We look at the totality of the circumstances. Does the evidence match up with the other facts? Who was the witness? Was there really any torture, or is it all just a story? Which happened? What did the detainee do or say that corresponds with the classified evidence? Just use your common sense.
So in this case?
In this case, the captured informant knew the detainee's name, his address in Afghanistan, his engineering background. Couple that with a declaration from our own intelligence services.
All of which the detainee had no chance to respond to, because as an alleged enemy combatant, he's not allowed to see or confront the classified evidence against him.
It's the same rule that all detainees must face.
Excuse me, Colonel. So we have this informant who's maybe being tortured, and he might be naming names to stop that. And we're supposed to evaluate this tortured informant.
Allegedly tortured informant.
I think what the captain is asking, if I may, is without meeting or interrogating this allegedly tortured informant, how do we determine what really happened? And then without knowing any of those details, how do we make a determination of what is reliable evidence and what is bullshit?
Not my words exactly, but yes, sir.
Richard, please.
This is a deliberation, Carol. I'm deliberating.
Look, Captain, our orders and procedures are very clear. We're not assigning guilt or innocence. We're simply trying to make sure that the detainees have been properly classified as unlawful enemy combatants.
Yes, but if classified as such, doesn't that mean that the detainee can be kept here until the president decides that the war on terror is over? Whenever that may be.
Yes, technically.
And that's not a guilty sentence to you? This is getting really hard to stomach. The UCMJ clearly
states... The Uniform Code of Military Justice is not in play here.
It's why it was created.
It was created before Al-Qaeda decided to fly planes into skyscrapers. Congress approved the rules of the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. Plus, there's the classified evidence against this detainee.
Oh, okay, but in the Hamdi decision, didn't the Supreme Court say that the government's classified evidence there was highly suspect?
Yes, the court said it amounted to little more than a bunch of unsubstantiated hearsay.
Hamdi was an American citizen. This is completely different.
Because this man is not a U.S. citizen? How do we claim the moral high ground if we don't treat everybody the same, just as we expect our own people to be treated?
Whoa, don't start comparing these tribunals to the terrorists and their tactics. Horrible things were done in Abu Ghraib. I won't deny that. But seriously, That is just a very small sampling of our troops and our mission.
It's not just Abu Ghraib. If these detainees weren't Islamic extremists before they got to Guantanamo, what is locking them up here for 4 or 5 years turning them into? What are we creating here?
You're measuring us doing stress positions or playing loud rap music all night to the terrorists with their beheadings and their mass executions and their blowing up markets and trains filled with children. I don't see a comparison, Richard.
Why is that the comparison? Why don't we measure our behavior against who we say we are and tell ourselves we are as a country?
That's a little simplistic after 9/11, don't you think?
Okay. If 9/11 is the measuring stick, are we a great nation because of the blow we took or because of how we as a country respond to that blow? The response matters. Our response defines us.
But we're not the ones who get to decide that message. You say you want us to behave by the book. Well, the Constitution expressly puts the power of these foreign policy decisions into the hands of the elected president.
And if the policy goes against the Constitution and the Uniform Code of Military Justice?
Don't get all high and mighty, Richard. You have no authority to decide what's constitutional or not. Hell, the Supreme Court can't even come up with a defining doctrine on all this.
That's not true. Look at Razul. Look at Hamna. The Supreme Court is clearly troubled by this whole process. As it is now, the detainees don't get a lawyer. They don't get to see the key evidence against them. Forget the UCMJ. This goes against the Magna Carta.
Congress legitimized these tribunals when they passed the Military Commissions Act. The law on this is perfectly clear. The courts have no jurisdiction in this.
The court has no say in the law. This doesn't sit wrong with you?
No. We can go round and round, but that doesn't change the facts. Our detainee's complete unresponsiveness to our questions, coupled with the way he danced around his views on jihad, plus the classified evidence. Please, this builds a very compelling case against this man.
You found him completely unresponsive.
Yes, I did. Agreed?
No. But I do wish we had something more substantial to go on, particularly if we don't know the reliability of the classified evidence we do have.
You have to admit, Carol, this is pretty flimsy.
Plus, we also have to consider who turned Alucard over to U.S. forces. He wasn't captured on the battlefield. According to the classified report, the Northern Alliance turned him over in exchange for a bounty from the U.S. military.
Exactly. $10,000 for every alleged Taliban member and $25,000 for every alleged Al-Qaeda fighter. No questions asked. It's a fortune over there.
It ain't a bad day over here either, Colonel.
The Northern Alliance was our ally in Afghanistan, gentlemen. This is not a criminal trial. I wish we had the luxury of calling in witnesses and watching undercover videos where our defendant is shown actually assembling the bomb. It would be great if we did. Hell, I'd pop the popcorn. But we got a war going on here. Two wars, actually. And we do not have the luxury of perfect due process.
Is a somewhat thorough investigative process a luxury?
In a war zone, where our troops are being shot at and blown up every day? And what about the danger of releasing possible classified information?
So all this is the best, worst possible solution?
Those aren't my words, Captain, I guess.
But how is the detainee supposed to prove something when he doesn't even get to see the evidence against him?
Well, the detainee is still presumed innocent.
True, but with this cockamamie tribunal logic, the classified evidence against the detainee, which the detainee can't see, remember, is presumed to be correct without question. So doesn't that poison the basic presumption of innocence?
Captain, you just got back from Iraq, didn't you? You saw what's going on over there.
This car bomb went off just inside the green zone. A couple American contractors got killed, and because somebody knew somebody, I was sent to get the bodies released from the morgue. There was this young Iraqi woman there, pleading with some bureaucrats. So I asked my translator to find out what was up. He tells me that her husband died in a different car bombing a couple days earlier, but because she was Sunni and the bureaucrats were Shiite, they were giving her problems releasing the body. I talk to my contacts, push the paperwork through. Then I find out that she still can't get the body back to her hometown because she can't get through all the different tribal neighborhoods safely. I arrange for a Humvee to escort them back. Now you have a U.S. Humvee with a dead Iraqi guy on top. They hit another IED. And a U.S. soldier dies. Another loses an eye. We never found anything from the dead Iraqi guy. But the joke was that he got blown up twice.
And your point, Captain?
I was hoping things would make more sense back here. I'm not sure what weight, if any, to give to a confession that maybe or allegedly comes from torture. But there are these coincidences. A PhD engineer working for a terrorist front, maybe he doesn't know anything. But maybe he does.
But is that enough?
Who the hell knows? Colonel, I just wish we had more.
But we don't, and we're not going to. You willing to take a chance on letting a terrorist bomb maker walk away?
Are you willing to keep him locked up based on suspect evidence he can't even hear? If we're fighting an ideological war, shouldn't we be holding on to an idea worth fighting for, say, like the Constitution or the rule of law?
We are compelled to make the best decision we can under the laws we've been given. Obviously, there's not a perfect solution.
The imperfection of the process does not require us to overlook the imperfection of the evidence, and this is all we have to hold him potentially for the rest of his life. There are just too many shortcuts being taken. I'm compelled to vote no.
I respectfully disagree. This is not an intellectual debate. Our responsibility is clear, and the risks are not imaginary. There is more than enough to classify this detainee properly and legally.
Okay. One for, one against. So it's up to you.
Take your time, Captain. We'll be outside.